Brought to you by the Computer History Museum.
Welcome to From the Archives of the Computer History Museum. I'm curator Chris Garcia. Welcome to our second episode in Henry Tropp's talk, The 1940s, the First Personal Computer Era, at the 1977 West Coast Computer Fair held in San Francisco. If you haven't heard the first part, please go back to the last episode.
I'd like to talk a little bit about England, and one of the reasons I would is because of the center of gravity. If you think back to the center of gravity in the 40s, it has to be someplace in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. It's kind of a weird-shaped, irregular polygon with vertices at places like MIT, perhaps the Moore School, von Neumann's project at Princeton, Aiken's work at Harvard. Then there are these projects in England. And somewhere, if you look at that irregular figure, there's a center of gravity someplace in the Atlantic Ocean. And the environment was rather interesting, as I have talked about before. Howard Aiken, who ran the Mark I project, really opened up that laboratory. Anybody who came in was welcome. He would spend an incredible amount of time taking them through it, show them how it worked. If they weren't doing a classified problem, they could watch runs, watch output. And he organized conferences at Harvard, you know, get the information out. Wilkes, when he got EDSAC running at Cambridge, had two symposia every month in which everybody in England who was interested was invited. Get the information out. On the west coast of the United States, there were a group of guys in the aircraft industry, and they had problems. Building and designing aircraft takes a lot of mathematics. The guys at Northrop, for example, had contracted for Beinac. Some of them knew about it, some of them didn't, but they really had no hopes for Beinac. A couple of guys named Woodbury and Tobin practically destroyed the powers that be at IBM because they had the temerity to take an IBM sorter and a multiplier and take the tops off of them and run some cable between them. So instead of a step and fetch it, you could run these cards continuously. And that led to IBM building something called the CPC, the Card Program Calculator, which came out of the Northrop environment. Another thing that came out of the Northrop environment was something called MDIDA, a Magnetic Digital Differential Analyzer, which is a fascinating device done by a group of people. And so there was this activity going on primarily in Southern California. And when we look at the origins of what we now call the production model IBM 701, which was really one of the first, although probably not the first, it was primarily for this group in Southern California. Fred Grunberger did a survey of the computers that were operative in the United States in 1957, and he found that the largest concentration was in the Los Angeles area, and there were precisely 32 of them. It was the largest. In fact, there's more computing power at Macy's department store in a pocket calculator section, if you think of number of operations per second, and there wasn't a world in 1957. One of the early machines, and you had this other center in England, and really in the late 40s, there was a kind of an interesting flow of information. Aiken has often been described by many people as having kind of tunnel vision. He knew precisely where he wanted to go and how to get there, and he never let anything interfere. And as far as information, it was kind of a one-way flow from Aiken to anybody who was interested. He'd go to Europe, he'd talk, and if you look at the early Eastern European or Western European machines, they're philosophically and architecturally very much spin-offs on the Harvard Mark I, II, III, and IV. And he was perfectly willing to come out to California and help these guys at Northrop, and the information kind of flowed that way. And it flowed towards England, and things flowed back from England. For example, development of electrostatic memory in the pre-transistor era were primarily modifications of the tube that Tom Williams built at Manchester, and the Williams tube became ultimately a fairly reliable memory device. So there was this information flow back and forth. When you talk to the people on the West Coast who were in that era from 1947, say, till the early 1950s, they have a common complaint. They say they were perfectly willing to come out. Mockley, Grace Hopper, everybody was always coming out to the West Coast to tell us what they were doing, but nobody was interested in what we were doing. It was just kind of a one-way flow. So you have this information from east to west, dead end. From New York or the East Coast to England, back and forth. From the East Coast to Western Europe in kind of a one-directional flow. And a gentleman named Lord Bowden, I'll find that in just a second, describes the early period with the Ferranti. The gentleman, Ted Nelson, is going to follow me. He's going to talk about the future. One of the things I learned about the early era is everybody's predictions were awful. They were lousy. Von Neumann, for example, said, gee, if we ever get a half dozen of these things around, that'll take care of the world's computing needs for 10 years or so. Von Neumann, for all of his greatness, was a lousy prognosticator. Lord Bowden, who was involved in the early development, talks about going to see a man named Douglas Hartree, who was probably England's most knowledgeable man on differential analyzers. Hartree wrote one of the earlier texts on the computer, taught at the University of Illinois for a while after the war. And the Manchester computer was taken over by this company in England, and ultimately by 1951 they were ready to produce a production model, in fact they had, of a thing called the Ferranti computer. And so this is an account of his conversation. He said, he told me in his opinion all calculations that would ever be needed in this country could be done on the three digital computers that were then being built, one in Cambridge, one in Teddington, and one in Manchester. No one else, he said, would ever need machines of their own or would be able to afford or buy them. He added that the machines were exceedingly difficult to use and could not be trusted to anyone who was not a professional mathematician, and he advised Ferranti to get out of the business and abandon the idea of selling any more of them. Howard Aiken, I think, was really a man of great vision, but even he showed the lack of it. I'm trying to recall one of the stories, but on one of the Harvard early machines, they used an IBM electric typewriter as their output, and it maybe did 20 characters a second. And somebody suggested to Howard that it wasn't going to be very much effort to really speed up the output printer. And he said he thought about it for a few minutes, and he said, don't bother. Who would ever want us to print any faster than one person can read? I should mention that Howard Aiken was also the gentleman who, when I interviewed him shortly before his death, we were sitting in his study in Florida, and I had a pack of cigarettes sitting on a footstool, and we were talking about his consulting work. Howard was then 70 or 71 years old, and he was a consultant to Monsanto Chemicals on something called magnetic bubbles, which fortunately I'd read about in Scientific American the year before. So I at least heard the word, but I didn't understand them. And he picked up my pack of cigarettes in his hand, and he looked at it, and he said, Hank, would you believe that in the early 1980s, in something not much bigger than this, you're going to be able to pack what is now $1 million worth of processing equipment and sell it for, probably $800. I kind of fell off my chair at that time, and that was the end of that conversation. And it may turn out that he's probably right. I wanted to say something about, I kept listening to people around the auditorium today talking about this, the problem of software. And what problem? I don't know if he's here. When we think of programming languages, one of the best known, of course, is Fortran. And the gentleman who's generally credited with Fortran is John Backus. And John was around all day today. I don't know if he's here tonight. John started working for IBM, and one of his first projects was on a monster machine called the SSEC. The SSEC was Tom Watson Sr.'s answer to the fact that he didn't get credits for the Harvard Mark I like he felt he should have. And ENIAC was big, and he wanted one, too. And besides, Wallace Eckert had a lot of astronomical calculations to do, and so they built the SSEC. They weren't quite sure about the electronics, so it's, although it's primarily electronic, it's also partially electromechanical. And so I remembered a conversation with John about the SSEC, and as we were standing in line this morning, waiting to try to find out how pre-registered people could get into the auditorium. I told John that I was probably going to use that tonight. And he said, you know, those early computers compared to the stuff I'm working with today were really very easy to program. And I hope I can find it without too much trouble. But even if I can't, the way John describes things is, I think, very fascinating. He's talking about the SSEC. The time is probably about 1950. He said it was a very nice machine to program. It sort of boggles the mind of anyone who programmed later machines, because you spent, you know, 6 or 9 months programming your job. Then you took the machine over for 2 or 3 weeks, or 4 weeks, totally. And so I reminded John of that comment of his, and he said, so you think it takes any less time today? He said, when you had total access to it, he said, I mean, nobody else tried to work on it while you checked out about 36 plug boards that determined the behavior of the machine, even including the operation codes and the tapes that you had punched that were card stop tapes. It had 66 tape stations that each read card went by, because the length of a punch card with 80 columns were divided into 20 binary coded decimal digits, and they could read 20 lines a second, at which point somebody says, 66 piano rolls? He said it was binary coded decimals, a very advanced machine in many ways, in that it was asynchronous, it had an electronic arithmetic unit with 8 one-word registers that were all made of vacuum tubes, and occupied about as large a wall as that one over there. Each binary digit of those 8 20-decimal-digit binary-coded decimal-digit registered, occupying a space about a foot square, and he went on about the vacuum tube space and the air conditioning and so on. The rest of the machine, aside from those units, was electromechanical, could store 150 20-decimal-digit binary-coded words in its memory, which consisted of 2 relay racks about half again as high as this room. Backstage, this huge monstrosity, you had all the electromechanical control devices. It did about 20 instructions a second in each of 3 addresses, plus the address of the next instruction or the next tape station from which the next instruction was to be seen. Once you had spent your 3 or 4 weeks testing out all of your tapes and plug boards, you were in total control with running the program that went on for months. These are essentially astronomical calculations he's talking about. And if you think about it, one ballistic trajectory takes about 750 calculations of these nonlinear partial differential equations, and I think they are the equivalent of 12,000 trajectories for one orbital calculation. And you had to be there, because the thing would run for only about 3 or 4 minutes at a time without a failure, at which time you were running everything in total duplicate. You really only had a memory of 75 words instead of 150, because you stored everything in duplicate and shifted one to one half the memory and did everything, and you coded everything so that about every 5 or 6 lines of code you checked to see if the results actually agreed. If they didn't agree, you stopped. The machine stopped, and there was a pilot switch for every memory cell. And you could put those memory cells on lights, in binary-coded decimal neon lights, and you could read out and compare the two things, and then go over and hit the tape stations in which the subroutine was failing. And you would turn these two tape stations one at a time and compare the results each time and look at the coding and everything, see where the result was, and then you'd go over and set the tapes back to a decent restart position and go. So every 3 minutes, you spend 5 minutes checking out what went wrong. And as John says, that's his beginning experience with programming. I think there's another marvelous story about beginning experience with programming, and this came from Morris Wilkes. We were sitting around talking to a group of people, and I luckily had a tape recorder on, recording this thing, and he was talking about EDSAC, which was a modified slower version of the projected EDVAC machine, which didn't go on the air until 1952. He said, I remember when we first got pulses circulating rather precariously. Every time we switched on the light in the room, another pulse went in. The lights were their input. In fact, that, in the early days of EDSEC, that was the only input they had. He said, later, we managed to make a half adder work, and we saw our binary pulses counting up on an oscilloscope screen. Then we got the accumulator working, then the whole arithmetic unit, and so on. We were a small, informal group in those days, and whenever we had anything to celebrate, we adjourned to the local pub. It's a pub known to generations of workers in Cambridge University laboratories. His name was the Bun Shop. But he said, I think you'd be rather surprised if you tried to buy a bun there. We have a very special celebration on the 6th of May, 1949, when EDSAC did its first calculation, which was a table of squares. And a few days later, it did a table of primes. And then he thought a minute and he said, you know, Sam Alexander reminded me about the first substantial program that I wrote, which was for computing Airy functions, A-I-R-Y, for solving the Airy differential equation. And he said, in connection with that, I made a discovery. I discovered debugging. And he looked around, he said, you probably won't believe me, and I don't know whether anybody else in this room has had the same experience, but it just had not occurred to me that there was going to be any difficulty about getting programs working. He said it was really quite a shock to him personally that he realized at that moment that he was going to spend the rest of his life and a good deal of his time finding mistakes that he himself had made in programs.
From the archive of the Computer History Museum is drawn from the audio holdings of the Computer History Museum. It is produced by curator Christopher J. Garcia. Music is by John Plute. Thanks for listening.
This program was brought to you by the Computer History Museum.